Podcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, June 13th, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Please note that our shows will also be archived on DrSaputo.com.
You'll be hearing Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour, and we have a great show for you today that will include the new FDA warning about prostate drugs, Avodart and Proscar.
And does the fear of dying during a heart attack make it worse?
And what did the FDA come out with regarding a serious safety problem with high-dose statins?
And much more. Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics, you can give us a call here at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Well, we were going to talk about prostate cancer risk in men that are on reductase inhibitors. So what does that mean? Well, as men age, their prostate gland tends to enlarge, which can make it difficult to urinate, or it makes them go more often because they have difficulty getting it out. So doctors often prescribe drugs such as the Avodart and the Proscar to reduce the size of the prostate, making it easier to urinate. But a new study finding shows that this class of drugs can increase the risk of lethal high-grade prostate cancers. Do we even know what we're doing?
Isn't that the truth? You know, when we talk about any drug that we put in the human body, it's always a grand experiment. And we don't get the real answers for what that's going to be like until sometimes decades later. It's not uncommon for a drug to go off the market 15, 20, 30, or even 50 years after it comes out, because finally somebody's taken a look at what it does. When you look at a metabolic pathway chart and see that there are thousands of reactions that occur inside of a single cell at every second, it's amazing that that all gets coordinated. Then you take something and you put it in the body and you expect it's going to do just what you want it to do. You've got a lot to learn because drugs don't work that way. They work in lots of different places. Now we're talking about two drugs that really make a lot of sense in some ways. Both Proscar and Avodart decrease the amount of prostate tissue that's there. And what happens as we men age is our prostate glands in general tend to enlarge. And because the urethra goes through the prostate, as the prostate enlarges,
it puts pressure on there, making not as much room.
And it's harder to urinate because you've got a smaller tube. So if you use something like Proscar or Avodart, and you reduce the volume there, it should be wonderful. And then a lot of doctors were thinking, well, it actually lowers the risk for developing prostate cancer. And guess what? It's true. It does. It lowers the risk for the total number of prostate cancers. But as it turns out, the prostate cancers that matter are the ones that are the serious ones that are going to go on and kill you. Those cancers increase in number.
That's so scary.
And all of a sudden we find out that maybe our risk is up 70%. Over if we didn't take the drug at all. And yet the number of cancers that are not lethal, they're reduced. That's not exactly what you'd hope for, but that's what happens when you do a study and you look at big numbers, the total numbers, and you don't break it down into subgroups.
So if I were a guy and I was listening to our show right now, I think I'd be asking, what else could I do besides taking these drugs? Because the symptoms are just so annoying to have to keep going to the bathroom all the time because I can't empty out. So what am I supposed to do?
Well, that's exactly right. And there are drugs you can take. There are lots of drugs called alpha blockers, things like Hytrin and Cardura that work pretty well to relax that sphincter in the bladder that allows urine to get into the urethra. And that actually can help a lot. But they have side effects too, like they lower your blood pressure. And if they lower your blood pressure too much, you've got a real problem. In fact, you could pass out. You could decrease your blood flow to the heart and to the brain in areas where there are blockages because now there's not enough pressure, and actually induce a heart attack or a stroke. And I can remember a few years ago, I was playing in a national seniors doubles tournament on grass in hot weather. And I was in the 60-year-old division, and this person was in the 70-year-old division. And all of a sudden, this guy collapsed, and he was a guy that was in tremendous shape. And I ran over to where he was and took his pulse and found that he was in atrial fibrillation with a heart rate of about 140 and a barely detectable pulse. And as the story finally came out, he said, yeah, I'm taking Hytrin. I said, well, there you are. You have to gauge what you're going to do every single day, particularly if you're a professional athlete like you are in senior tennis.
Well, is there a supplement that people can take?
Definitely. Now we're looking at some good stuff. Salt palmetto, along with Pygium and some other oils and zinc, can really do a lot to reduce the size of the prostate. They don't get much in the way of press, but it's amazing how the word gets out. And I'd say most senior men who have problems with their prostate that have done any kind of research on the internet, they look all the time to see what's coming out. Most of them know about it. In fact, when they come to see me, they tell me, yeah, I'm taking some salt palmetto. I'm going, well, that's good. The question,
what is salt palmetto?
It's just an herb. It's found in the southwestern U.S. as its primary source.
And then what's Pygium?
It's just another substance that's in it that kind of increases the effect of how it works. Mm-hmm. So what we have is a reasonable solution to start with that doesn't seem to cause any problems that we can tell at this point. But you still also have to keep an open mind that it could be that we just haven't done studies that are big enough. It's always the problem when you don't have enough in the way of money to be able to know that that what you're doing is safe. If you can't do a large clinical trial, prospective trial, that gives you a certain treatment, then you see what happens over time. That takes millions and millions of dollars to do, and most of the supplement companies don't have that kind of money, so the studies never get done. The pharmaceutical industry can do big studies, and it would be great if when they did their studies, they shared all their information with us, but we know they don't. And when they don't, then the information that we'd like to know is simply never comes into our view, and we wind up doing it anyway. So I think the National Institutes of Health has let us, we the people, down. They're the people that really are doing the bulk of the research. It's all the government research, but it's only about half as much as Big Pharma does. But still, they should be doing the studies that we need to know the answers for. It shouldn't be stuck just in mainstream medicine like pharmaceutical drugs or technologies. It should be all those wonderful things that have been around for years that the indigenous healers of the world used. We should be looking at the effects of a lot of herbs and supplements and nutrients and natural substances that have been around forever, and looking at some of the styles that we use in practice that have to do with placebo, even things like voodoo. Powerful stuff that we just look at and go, oh, that's baloney. But look what happened, you know, when the last earthquake was in one of the small islands in the Caribbean. Huge problem. And what happened? The voodoo people were doing a lot of work that caused amazing effects on people. So just because we don't understand something doesn't mean
to throw it out.
Exactly.
Well, you know, the best anti-aging medicine is lifestyle.
For
and
sure.
It seems like if a person lived a healthy lifestyle, getting enough exercise and eating the right diet and mm-hmm. stress reduction and getting enough sleep and all that, mm-hmm. that it might help to keep the prostate gland healthy.
You'd have to bet that that's probably true. You know, it could be that it's just a part of natural aging. Mm-hmm. I think most people do think that. Mm-hmm. But you would never know because we're exposed to tens of thousands, probably 100,000 new chemicals that are man-made, that are now in the environment, that are causing all kinds of havoc. They're endocrine disruptors as well. So we're looking at issues here that are really important that we don't know enough about. I think that's right. And then, of course, doing things like exercise and eating a healthy diet and reducing your stress levels, weighing what you should, and having purpose in your life. These are all big things that we should be using that are important in what we're doing to maintain our good health. There is no medicine that comes close to the power of lifestyle as there in the world. None of the pharmaceutical drugs hold a candle to it. In fact, most of the time when you look at the drug inserts and they're talking about something that has an effect, such as the bisphosphonates, the Fosamax and Boniva and Digrenal and all those, or the statin drugs, they always say, healthy lifestyle. Make sure you're taking in enough of certain nutrients like vitamin D in the case of osteoporosis. That's common knowledge, but we don't respect it as we should.
If you have any questions about your health and you'd like to give us a call, the number here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Many studies now are showing that heart attacks often lead to depression, and now a study gets pretty specific about it. We know that heart disease is the number one killer in the world, and we see drama in movies with people dying from heart attacks, and we do know that depression is common out of a heart attack. So this new study gets specific, and it shows that if a person has intense distress and fear of dying while they're having the heart attack, a worse outcome is expected. So it appears that our emotions are very closely related to our biology.
Absolutely.
But what can a person do to help themselves not get so scared while they're having it?
That's a problem. It depends on what your degree of faith is and trust that our life here on this planet is really just an instant when you look at the billions of years and trillions of years that it's been around. And so we have this idea that when we die that something really scary is going to happen. And you can look at it that way, but the deeper your faith, the more your spiritual connection, the more trusting you are that things will be okay. I think a lot of the time when we feel alone, that's when it's the scariest, because who's there with us? Because our life, our biggest meaning in life is probably our relationships and how we deal with that. I think if I were having a heart attack, I'd want you holding my hand and at my side. And that would make such a big difference.
The trouble is that you never know where you're going to be or where it could happen.
And that's why you have to work on your spirituality and your faith as well at the same time.
But when you think about it, too, you know, this fear factor, we hear the expression that somebody was scared to death and maybe they just died because they were scared.
No question.
Or also you hear of people dying after a spouse dies.
Exactly. That's that aloneness part that can be devastating. Depression's a terrible thing. And, you know, what you think, what your mind believes has a powerful effect on your biochemistry and your physiology. I know of nothing that orchestrates a symphony of release of hormones and different chemicals and neurotransmitters in our body than that. It's really something that's amazing.
One of the things that I thought was pretty impressive is that when a person is scared like this, it increases the inflammation 4 times.
Exactly. And so we're measuring things like tumor necrosis factor and cortisol levels that are going up. And I'm sure adrenaline and noradrenaline do as well. And then we look at things like heart rate variability, which is a way of measuring the regularity of a heartbeat, which happens to be the most predictive test in all of medicine, the most predictive test in all of medicine of all-cause mortality and of heart disease. Of heart attack. So when you measure these factors, the tumor necrosis factor, the cortisol and heart rate variability, they all go awry.
What's tumor necrosis factor mean? I mean, well, how's that related to a heart attack? It sounds like it has something to do with a tumor.
Well, that's the way it was discovered. But in actuality, what it is just a marker that tells you that there's inflammation in the body. There are a lot of interleukins that do the same thing and many other chemicals that have an effect on the level of inflammation in the body. And so that's what you're looking at.
Also know that inflammation is one of the big causes of high cholesterol, because the cholesterol is going to the inflammation in the arteries to kind of soothe it and patch it up. And then what happens if it's inflamed is it...
Right. And about 20% of people who have a heart attack are in this group of intense fear causing these terrible biological changes. The answer is not to use antidepressants. And, of course, that's how the mainstream doctors think. Somebody's depressed. What drug can I use to try and do that? But you don't have a deficiency of some antidepressant in your bloodstream. That's just a way of modifying your neurotransmitters and doing a lot of other things that haven't yet been disclosed because we haven't figured them out to change your level of anxiety or of depression. And so we shouldn't be depending on that unless there's no other way. We should be trying to be with rather than do to our patients.
Well, this is where the body, mind, emotion, spirit connection is so important, to realize this connection and the importance of personalized care with people, that they're not just a number. They're not just the patient with a heart attack in room 340.
You're right. And we need to have some kind of connection to our patients. We need to be with them, supporting, loving them, connecting with them, reassuring them, that does a lot to calm things down, to lower the level of inflammatory agents that are in our bloodstream, to slow down the risk factors for complications and for death that are associated with any illness, let alone a heart attack or a stroke. Well, it's time for your first 2020 tip, Vicki, and what we're going to be doing here is linking to a vaccine that's linked to sudden infant death.
Hepatitis B vaccine is highly linked to SIDS, that sudden infant death syndrome, as well as many of the serious side effects with many other vaccines, things that are like fever and headache and joint pain and weakness and irritability. But there can be more dangerous reactions that can include allergies and ADD and ADHD, and things like multiple sclerosis and lupus and Guillain-Barré, convulsions, autism, and even death. And the thing that really stands out here is that hepatitis B is not a childhood disease.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean,
we're giving it to newborns who don't have a mature immune system and thinking that, oh, well, we might as well give it to them now because by the time they're 13 or 15 or whatever, we're going to run into a problem.
So hepatitis B, first of all, you need to know it's a disease of the liver, but it's spread like AIDS. It's through the blood and the semen. And when I say through the blood, it's usually like sharing of needles. And yet the hepatitis B vaccine is required before children enter school from preschool through college, starting the vaccines at 12 hours of age. And three of them are required. You know, just recently we were visiting some friends that have a newborn.
Six-week-old baby, yeah.
Yeah, just a newborn. And I said, did you get the hepatitis B? Oh, yeah, we got it.
Oh,
we're scheduled for the next one. Like, you know, people think they're trying to be a good parent. And I used
That's
to
right.
be that way, too, when my children were little before I
Well, thank God that wasn't around at that time.
Before we learned all these things.
I mean, 75 vaccines by the time you're 18 is a little excessive.
Yes, 75, yes. And also, vaccine exemptions are different in each state, but they can include medical, religious, and philosophical reasons. And I think that this is good for parents to be aware of. And I think what people should do is look it up for your state and just be aware that even if you tell the hospital that you don't want a hepatitis B vaccine for your child, for your newborn, that there's a possibility that they might give it to your baby anyway. So what you can do is tell your husband to keep an eye on that baby when you're busy or whatever, and the rest of the time have the baby with you rather than, you know, putting them in the nursery. But if they're in the nursery, you have your husband go check in on them because sometimes these things happen. So the other thing that happens is that these vaccines that are being given for these infants that aren't even a high risk for hepatitis B, they wear off. And usually if they do get to a place where they think that they might want to get this vaccine, they have to do it again anyway.
Great. That's beautiful, Vicki. I think that's really important stuff to note. That's a great tip. A lot of the time we think, can a million doctors be wrong? And the answer is absolutely, because where do we get our information? From the CDC.
You know, there are some pediatricians that will tell you that they won't even take care of your baby if you don't get them these vaccines.
Okay, we had a call from someone named Deb who was asking about she's having some problems with neuropathy. It sounds like she's got this static electric feeling in her feet. A lot of people have this, particularly if they have type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes. And I would say after about 10 years of having either one of those illnesses, your risk for developing peripheral neuropathy, which is where the nerves, the feet, don't function like they should because they aren't getting blood flow to the nerves. The sympathetic nervous system causes a constriction of the blood flow to the nerves of the feet. And when that happens, you get these numb feet, and you also get problems with this searing pain, this burning electrical-like discharge, especially at night. And a lot of people can't even walk without a lot of discomfort. So, Deb, we've got some good news for you. We're doing a clinical trial right now at the University of California, San Francisco, where I'm an assistant clinical professor, by the way, on how we use infrared light therapy in treating chemotherapy-induced nerve damage that's peripheral neuropathy. We did a previous study that was published a few years ago on the effects in diabetes, and, of course, I have a lot of clinical experience using it as well. And when you have this problem, if you use the infrared light that's about 860 nanometers and you use the right form of it and deliver it the right way, the effects are amazing. You actually, in two or three treatment for most people who have type 2 diabetes and peripheral neuropathy and many other causes of neuropathy, two or three treatments at the beginning very often will make the process stop and disappear. We usually can stop the pain in a couple of days, unless it's far advanced disease, and even then sometimes we can. So this is one of the most major breakthroughs I've seen in medicine in my entire career.
It's really fun to watch because the people tend to say, oh, I can feel my feet, I can feel my feet.
And then the pain is gone.
The pain's gone.
It's like magic. So this new technology, you can go to our website at drsaputo.com and put in infrared light therapy, and you'll see many articles come up on that that will give you a good idea of how that infrared light works, what it does, the conditions it treats, which is almost any pain condition there is, including reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is CRPS 1 and 2, in my opinion. I've had about 11 or 12 years of experience with this. I'm working with the person that invented the technology. We're using very sophisticated infrared scanners to do our work. It's really been something. So, Deb, that's what you do, in my opinion. Thanks for the call.
The number here, if anybody else has questions about their health, is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888. Well, the FDA has been slow to react to some serious drug safety problems. More than 2 million Americans are taking unsafe doses of the statin Zocor, also known as simvastatin. But the FDA finally halted the 80-milligram dose. The usual dose is 10 to 20 milligrams. Statins, to remind you, are the drugs that lower LDL cholesterol.
Yeah, they raise HDL and they lower the total. They're supposed to have all these wonderful effects, some of which are positive, but there's so many other problems.
Well, to remind you, some of the other statins besides Zocor are Lipitor and Mevacor and Crestor, you know, and many more.
Right. And some combinations like Vytorin. It's amazing how the pharmaceutical companies are so resourceful at finding how to put combination drugs together. So they have things like Vytorin and Advacor and Caduet and something called Simcor, which are combinations of things like niacin or maybe Norvasc, which is an antihypertensive. So they're clever at marketing their products, and we're very gullible a lot of the time to bite into what they're suggesting because they really maximize the effects that we get and they minimize the downside.
Well, many of these statin drugs are known to have side effects like the neuropathy that we were just discussing that Deb asked about, and also they can affect the liver. And what is the big major one that we're talking about that the reason that the FDA is restricting the use of this Zocor?
It's a big, long name. It's called rhabdomyolysis. Nobody much out there knows what that means. But to make it simple, it just means that there's inflammation in the muscles that can cause pain, which so many people who take statins have and wonder why.
So this is a type of myopathy.
It's like an inflammation, yes, and a degeneration of the muscle that follows. So what you have is an inflammation, an actual inflammation in the muscle. See, one of the big things about statins is they're supposed to reduce inflammation. Now, maybe they reduce it in the arteries, but they don't reduce it in muscles. In fact, there was a study done a few years ago published in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at the problems that you get into with these statin drugs on muscles and inflammation. They had four patients who had normal muscle enzyme levels, who had no liver disease of any kind that they could find on lab testing. They were totally asymptomatic, and normally you wouldn't dream of doing anything about that, except that they wondered if there was still inflammation. So what they did is they biopsied the muscles of these people, stained them for inflammation, and what do you think they found?
They all had it.
All four of them had it. So you know that even at a subclinical level, you're adding to the whole buildup of inflammation in our body by taking a statin drug. So the more we learn, the less attractive they look in a lot of ways.
Okay, so you might think, oh, so I might have a little inflammation, my muscles might hurt a little bit. But what you might not realize is what can happen is that your muscles can break down and degenerate. And when they're degenerating, they try to get out of the body, and they try to get out through the kidneys. And when it tries to get through the kidneys, guess what happens? it clogs up the kidneys, and then you have kidney damage.
Yeah, it could be lethal. In fact, some drugs like Bakal have been taken off the market, and others like Crestor are ones that are at a high risk for it. And what's released? It's a pigment called myoglobin that's in muscles. And when it's released in massive amounts, that myoglobin plugs up the tubules in the kidney, cause renal failure and death in an awful lot of people. So we're looking at a problem here that's not a small one.
Okay, so the FDA is changing these labels because they want new dosing. Plus, here's the big one, I think. They're putting warnings on there not to take these statin drugs with various medications that include things like antifungals and antibiotics, HIV and AIDS drugs, amiodarone, which is given for serious heart problems, and some common blood pressure medications, and drugs like Norvasc for blood pressure, angina, congestive heart failure. This is just horrible.
Well, there are a lot of things that we don't recognize, and some of them are dose-related. And that's what the FDA is trying to tell us. And they're touching the tip of the iceberg, but they're touching it decades after we found out that this was a problem, which shows you the ties that they have between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry. We're going to come back to this because it's time for a quick station break. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number to call if you have a question about your health or want to participate in our conversation is 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more on statins and their dangers.
Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
Hello, everyone. This is Richard Martin, host of your bi-weekly wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, coming to you live all the way from Singapore. I try to cut through the lies and misinformation to bring you what you need to know to prepare for the economic horrors that lie ahead. I'll give it to you straight in simple language. I don't sugarcoat the news. Unlike the government and the media, I have no agenda other than to make you aware of ways in which you can protect yourselves and your loved ones. That's the Wake Up Call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. here on Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Sandra V. Tay from Success Power Talk. You can listen live to me every Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the very best success strategies for your life, bringing you sumptuous, exciting topics, expert guests, and panelists from all over. You will not want to miss. Email me at coach@tateworks.com if you have questions you want read on the air. If you missed any past shows, go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives to find them. Always take the best and leave the rest. Success Power Talks every Saturday, 4 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Why should you be listening to the Progressive Radio Network? Here are a few hosts that call PRN home. Award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker Michael Ruppert. Acclaimed theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. Notable media critic and international journalist, the news dissector, Danny Schechter. Leading progressive journalists such as Stephen Ledman, John Rappaport, and Glenn Ford have also found a home with us. We also have advice from Richard Martin on how to protect yourself from the ongoing financial collapse. John Mueller tells us his firsthand account on moving out of the U.S. and making a new life for himself in another country on his show, The Expat Files. Along with all all these informative programs, we also have health shows hosted by America's top doctors like Mayor Eisenstein, Cheryl Selman, and, of course, Gary Null. The Progressive Radio Network is the place for news and information. Progressive Radio Network, the driving force behind intelligent, thought-provoking commentary. If it's worth knowing, it's on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Savita here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We're talking about statin drugs and how they have some dangers when they're used in large amounts. And the FDA has come out and stated that for the drug Zocor, we shouldn't be starting out with the big doses of 80 milligrams a day because the side effects that lead to myopathy, to kidney failure, and to lots of problems with weakness and muscle pain are apt to be more common. And you'd have to bet that the other complications that are associated with the statin drugs would be the same. So,
and also the danger of taking these statin drugs along with some of these other medications that I mentioned before the break with the antifungals and antibiotics and some of the blood pressure and heart pills.
It's such a long list, and you would think that your doctors would be up to date on that, but I can tell you, the first 25 years of my practice, I was like every other doctor. I'd look at the physician's desk reference, which is our big book. It's like our Bible. And then I go in there and look to see if the drug had the positive effects that I was looking for. And if it did, I'd be inclined to try it because I had been brainwashed like most every other doctor in this country who thought if the FDA approved it, it must be okay. But the fact of the matter is you have to read that fine print. And 90% or 95% of what you read about in that big Bible is about side effects, complications, and contraindications, many of which are really serious.
And many many seniors are on more than one drug.
Oh, to go into a hospitalized hospital and see how many drugs a person is on, it may be 15 or 20 drugs. I know I have a patient now who has a cancer that had to be transferred to another hospital, and I've stayed in touch, but it's quite a commute to get there, so I often will call the doctors, and sometimes they'll give me a call back if things aren't going right. And I got a call a few days ago saying, hey, your patient's not doing so well. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, she's not so alert. She's acting a little bit dingy. She's sleeping a lot. We can't give her the treatment we want to give her very comfortably. We think maybe we should transfer her to a convalescent hospital. I said, first thing, read off to me the drugs you're taking. She was on 5 psychotropic drugs.
No wonder she was tired and not responding very well.
So my comment was, I'll tell you what, Doc, let's do a little experiment here.
You take
them. Let's put
them.
Those 5 pills in a little container. You take them home on Sunday morning or Saturday morning when you get home. You pop those in, and let's give you a call about 12 hours later and see how you're feeling. I can guarantee you what's going to happen.
Did you get the message?
Yeah, we do so many things like that in such a cavalier way. And believe me, there are no research studies, none, that look at when you take 4 or 5 drugs together, let alone when you take 2 a lot of the time. So we have to get very conservative about using things when we don't have enough information about what's going on. We have to look at the biochemistry in much more detail than we're capable of. And then, of course, we have the problem of the FDA letting a lot of things pass because they've got a incestuous relationship with Big Pharma and with the technology industry. And Big Pharma and the technology industry try to hold back all the problems that we hear about with the drugs that are causing problems because they want to sell the drug. You can even look at the direct-to-consumer ads. And when you see those direct-to-consumer ads and you see all the problems that are with nice background music, a little diarrhea, and there's constipation, and there's a stroke, and you can have a heart attack.
It's like nobody in their right mind would take him.
And it's like we tune out when it comes to that. We don't listen to what the words are actually saying. And we have to pay attention to that. And you know you can't trust an ad. What's an ad about? It's about convincing you that something's better than it actually is, so you'll buy it and they'll make money.
So it's our responsibility to take care of our own health.
Absolutely.
And one way that we take care of our own health, besides a healthy lifestyle, is to keep up with what's new in the news in medicine. And that's what we try to do here at Prescriptions for Health. Many times the doctors don't have time to keep up with what's new in the latest studies because they're busy. And so
that's a lot
of times they take shortcuts and they read the studies that are put out by the drug companies. And we all know that those are biased.
Yeah.
So it's something that you can't always just trust your doctor. You need to work as a team with the doctor and come in to the office prepared. You know, many doctors don't appreciate it when the patient gets information off the internet. But some doctors do appreciate that. But I think it's all of our responsibility to do this and to keep up with what's new, especially if you're on medication. And
well,
see
right.
first if there's a way to get off of it, if there's something you can do that's natural, and if there's not, then make sure that there's not contraindications and then know what the side effects are to be careful of. I have a friend that she had diarrhea for like a month or 6 weeks or something, and the doctor gave her some sort of electrolyte preparation. I don't remember what the name of it was. And I said, why don't you look at the side effects of that? Because she was getting worse when she was taking this. And that was the side effect, was bloating, distension, diarrhea. She's like, I just can't believe it. Why did the doctor give me this? I don't believe it.
Well, you have to understand doctors, most doctors are not scientists. They're clinicians. They're doing the practical things. They're taking information they read about in some paper someplace or some book or the CDC that says you should do this and you'll be on the right track. In fact, you might be punished if the standard of practice is to do that. You don't, and your patient somehow goes south. So this is a big issue. Doctors need to be trained to learn more about what the downsides of what they do are so that they're less likely to do it, and we get back to what I call lifestyle medicine. Well, it's time for your 2020 dip. We're all listening to Prescriptions for Health here. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. And Vicki's 2020 tip is going to be on the perks of aging.
Well, I have some of the perks of reaching age 50, being over 60, and heading towards 70. First of all, nobody expects you to run anywhere.
That's true.
People call at 9 p.m. or 9 a.m. and they ask, did I wake you?
Oh, geez.
People no longer view you as a hypochondriac.
That's right. You've got every disease. Huh?
And there's nothing left to learn the hard way.
Mm.
Things you buy now won't wear out. And you can eat supper at 4 p.m. if you feel like it. You can live without sex. But not your glasses. You no longer think of speed limits as a challenge. And you quit trying to hold your stomach in no matter who walks into the room.
Isn't that the truth?
You sing along with elevator music. Your eyes won't get much worse. Your investment in health insurance is finally beginning to pay off.
Yeah, really.
Your joints are more accurate meteorologists than the National Weather Service. And your secrets are safe with your friends because they can't remember them either.
Oh, that's great. Those are the perks of aging, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, it's good to have a sense of humor as you age or with whatever problems you have.
Well, that's right. I mean, humor is such a good healer. Norman Cousins' work is beautiful stuff. I mean, what he did to show the power of what we think and how our biochemistry is altered by our thoughts and our physiology is dependent on our biochemistry.
And that laughter is the best medicine.
It is. It makes all those endorphins come out so that we can have the good feeling that comes with living our lives the way we want to.
The number here at Prescriptions for Health, if you have any questions about your health, is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Boy, we got a lot of eights in there.
Yeah, so what else is new in the news, Vicki?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's often misdiagnosed as ADHD, mm-hmm. and the treatments are not the same. Now, studies recommend psychotherapy for PTSD, which
for sure.
is post-traumatic stress disorder, uh-huh. and stimulant drugs for the ADD and the ADHD, and those stand for attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about how post-traumatic stress disorder is defined so that we can get going on it.
Well, usually it takes some kind of traumatic event. It's not just for soldiers in war who have been on the battlefront, who have watched somebody be shot up and die, or you see a head shot off or an arm and people I mean, blood all over the place. Everybody who's in that setting, I don't care who you are, everybody in that setting is going to have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, the same thing with some of these natural disasters we've been having, like tsunami, the floods, the
earthquakes,
tornadoes, the fires,
any kind of severe trauma where you're seeing something happen that could threaten your own existence. You see it happening in someone else. And then we have all these things that happen in our dysfunctional families. We've got the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse.
And some
huge
of those,
factors
and
in
some
PTSD.
Of those might not seem as serious as what we were just describing, but they are to a child. And some of this abuse and trauma and neglect and stress can include things even just like being in a single parent home. If a child has a parent in prison, or if they've watched their parent being violently abused, say the husband beats them or what have you, a parent that's abusing drugs or alcohol. So like if you have a parent that's an alcoholic or a drug addict, that can give you symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so what happens is when children have this, it can increase behavior and learning problems by 10 times.
Oh, easy. Maybe more. Yeah. You see, when you're an adult and some of these things happen, you have the tools to deal with them. You're not going to allow somebody to emotionally, physically, or sexually abuse you most of the time. But kids don't have the tools. They're kids. And what happens to them, they can't resolve. So they do the best they can. And they repress this information. And when it's repressed, it stays there. It doesn't go away. And it continues to affect the way we respond to certain kinds of situations. There are triggers that will cause those old fears to come up that drive you to behavior that was, maybe appropriate for a kid that's 3, 5, or 15, but not appropriate for somebody that's older who has the tools that we need.
Well, you see, what's important is for the doctors to really try to distinguish whether the child's symptoms, if they have behavior problems or if they have cognitive problems, whether it is post-traumatic stress disorder, ADD, or ADHD, because so many times nowadays, everything's dismissed as ADHD, and they just put them on these drugs, which are things that are like amphetamines that can be addictive and so forth. But think about it. If a child is preoccupied, if a child is depressed, they're having problems at home, certainly it's going to distract them.
Of course.
And if their father's beating up their mother, they're going to many times have a tendency to be rough with other kids at school, to kind of be doing what they're seeing at home, or they're acting it out themselves. Mm-hmm. And then as far as concentrating in school, think about it. It's kind of like common sense, but many times that's overlooked. And by overlooking it, it's perpetuating it.
Exactly. And not only that, I mean, if you're barking up the wrong tree, you're calling all these kids having ADD or ADHD, you're overdiagnosing. You don't really think that 5% of our pediatric population should be on these drugs. What happens is we got such good advertising from the drug companies and such a strong statement from the government or organizations that are defining what they are, that we're over-treating, over-diagnosing way too many people. We need to go back and deal with the underlying causes of what's going on first. We need more psychological support in our schools. We need to be listening to our children more often. It shouldn't be this war going on between the teachers and the students, which too often happens, particularly in the lower socioeconomic classes. We have to find a way to listen to these kids first. Find out what's really going on. If you're really convinced this is ADD or ADHD, you might want to give a trial to one of the drugs. But if it was one of my kids that was on that, I'd probably insist on a SPECT scan or a functional MRI. Now you're talking about a lot of money, maybe spending $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 to get tests like that done. But you'll get answers, too.
Yeah, and people
because these
can't
tests,
always afford to do that.
No, they can't.
And they want to do what's quick, and they just give them a drug, and it shuts them up, I guess.
Well, there's a much safer way to go. I mean, we could look at the biochemistry of what's going on in kids that have ADD and ADHD, which hardly ever is done in the mainstream. I mean, David Horobin was a wonderful fat metabolism scientist. Unfortunately, died a few years ago.
You made it sound like he was fat.
No,
fat
he wasn't
scientist.
Fat. No, he wasn't fat at all. He was a thin Scotsman. And he was a beautiful scientist. And he went through and described some of the abnormal findings in essential fatty acid metabolism that were abnormal. Now, the essential fatty acids are those fats, those omega-3s and 6 fats that we hear about all the time, that our bodies can't make but must have in order to be able to function normally. And if we don't have those fats and they're not able to be metabolized by the body, then we don't have the benefit of using them.
And they're really healthy in the brain, aren't they?
They're, well, much of the brain, 55% of the brain is fat, and a lot of that is the EPA and DHA, okay, and arachidonic acid and the evening primrose oil, the gamma-linolenic acid that's in there, and it needs to be replaced in the right amounts. A simple thing to do is called an essential fatty acid profile. They're like $150. Get the test done. If your kid has ADD or ADHD, there's a good chance these essential fatty acid profiles are going to be highly abnormal. And what's the treatment? Replace them with the essential fatty acids they need. You can buy a product called Efalex. It's E-F-A-L-E-X, that I don't have any stock in, by the way. It's a beautiful drug that replaces the downchain metabolites of what we eat that we can't make in our body if we have these metabolic defects. So what we're looking at in ADD and ADHD is attention deficit, hyperactivity, impulsive behavior. They often have dyslexia, dyspraxia, which means they don't have good coordination, can't catch a ball right. They have night blindness oftentimes, and they have dry skin and concentrated urine. If your child is like that, you want to entertain the possibility of ADD or ADHD. Do the essential fatty acid test and find out if this defect, because in that case, you don't need to use those stimulant drugs, that Adderall or Concerta or the other ones that are out there that can cause problems.
Ritalin.
They cause all kinds of problems with rhythm disturbances and seizures and problems that you wouldn't want to take the risk of unless it was necessary. We rely on drugs way too often, and we have to get off that horse and start moving in a direction that makes a lot more sense.
And then now with the post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the things that's bad about this in kids is this can lead to adult illnesses.
That's for sure.
It impacts the person's physiology. And
big
it can lead to heart disease and obesity even.
We know that
increases the risk for cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff written on that.
And diabetes and inflammation.
Oh, yeah. Once you're in that ballpark and you've got all these stresses going on in your life, and maybe they lead to difficulty sleeping as well, now you've got a big problem with the consequences of lack of sleep. When the American Cancer Society did its study back in the 50s on 1 million people and looked at lifestyle factors and which ones impacted mortality and morbidity the most, they looked at smoking, lack of exercise, being overweight, being sedentary, and lack of sleep. Those people who had less than 4 hours a night of sleep had the highest mortality and the highest morbidity of all people there. So we're looking at something that is really important to pay attention to.
So before making a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD, the doctors need to rule out post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly.
Now, there's a workman's comp study. First of all, I want to throw out our number here. If you have any questions about your health, you need to get it in quick. It's 888-874-4888, 874-4888. There was a workman's comp study by medical and healthcare professionals outside the chiropractic profession that I think deserves some attention here. It seems that they are admitting in this study that chiropractic care is more effective for low back pain compared to medical doctors and compared to physical therapy. The expense is lower. They have shorter disabilities. They have fewer recurrences. They're on fewer drugs and surgeries. You know, low back pain is a very common problem. And in fact, it's so common that if you get a low back problem, all of a sudden you'll notice that everybody you know has had one time or another. But this is not new news in the chiropractic profession because it's in their journals all the time. But I think it's a big deal here that the medical profession admitted that chiropractic care is useful because it's been pretty competitive with chiropractic, and many times they criticize it and call them quacks.
Well, it becomes a turf war.
Yeah.
And as you said, this is a study that was done by non-chiropractors. It was done by physicians, and they came up with these results. I mean, chiropractic has been around a long time, and we know that it has a long history. And a lot of people use the services of chiropractors. And even a lot of the insurance companies and Medicare are starting to reimburse for chiropractic services.
Well, health insurance companies have been reimbursing for chiropractic for some time, like they all do it for acupuncture.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's growing. And that's because of public demand, because people want to use those services. Why? Because they seem to get better. And just because studies that have been done by non-chiropractors in the past show that they aren't so good, you'd have to imagine that the conflict of interest had something to do with their coming up with the conclusion that it wasn't so good.
I mean, I know personally. I mean, I've been seeing a chiropractor for quite a while now.
Mm-hmm.
And my back gets out of alignment, and the doctor puts it back in alignment, and I feel a lot better. And many times what happens is people's nerves get compressed mm-hmm. because their spine is out of alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And think about it. We're all connected. Our neck's connected. Actually, our jaw is connected to our neck. Our neck's connected to the
low back.
Cervical. It's the cervical, the thoracic, the lumbar, the sacrum, the tailbone, all of that. It's all connected.
Even down to the feet. So if something's off in your neck, so your alignment isn't right, it affects everything below it and probably above it as well. And then you wind up with mechanical stresses that are going to lead to deterioration of some area that's involved. And when that happens, you can use the drugs, you know, all the analgesics that there are, or you could use whatever therapies you want.
But you want to get at the cause is the main thing that I think we're trying to get across
here. So if the alignment is the problem, it's off. Because say you were in an auto accident, you had some kind of traumatic injury. If that's off, then you have to do something to fix that if you want to get well in a quick amount of time. If you give analgesics and you relax a little bit more, that's going to help for sure. To let the muscles relax and maybe it will self-adjust. But why not go to somebody who's been trained, you know, for a lot of years and had experience in school? I work with chiropractors all the time. You know, at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, California, we have an integrative clinic that has chiropractors and acupuncturists and body workers and people do nutrition, a lot of things that are outside the medical profession. Our patients love that because they don't just want to hear the same old story over and over again about here, take this pill. Which is a lot of the time what happens. And it's what is being recommended and taught in medical schools. Our education is really deteriorated into a very narrow approach. It's not scientific. If it were scientific, we'd have an open mind about looking at all the different kinds of disciplines that we have so that we can include them because they just might come in handy sometime, even if we don't understand them. Because let's face it, how much of what we do we understand anyway? What do we know about big pharma? What do we know about what a drug does? Why does it take 30 years sometimes for a drug to be discovered to be worse than its benefits are? Why can't we think about using energy medicine or using relaxation therapies? Why aren't they mainstream? It's because it's a business. What we have is less of a service and more of a business. So we need to refocus. We need to think for ourselves. We need to take a step back and recognize that what we're doing today in our formal mainstream medicine has some powerful, wonderful tools in it, but it's certainly not what you want to use as your first line of treatment.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to point out with back pain is many times it expresses itself like you might have a pain in your butt or your leg or your foot,
mm-hmm.
or that might be coming from your low back, or you might be having a pain that goes down your arm
from
into
your
fingers. And
yeah, sure. Cervical disc problems can start with pain in the wrist, as it did with you at one point in time. And a lot of people have sciatica where they have pain maybe just in their ankle, and the pain's coming from their back.
And sometimes an adjustment will correct that, and the pain will go away because it's getting at the cause. If you take a pain pill, it might take the edge off of the pain, but it's not getting at the cause.
That's right. So we have to look at integrative approaches, and that's what we do.
And there are plenty of other integrative approaches besides chiropractic also with complementary alternative medicine. We mentioned acupuncture, but there's, you know, even things like stretching and certain exercises. There's ultrasound. There's energy therapies like Reiki and homeopathy. There's energetic electromagnetic things. There's magnets. There's the TENS unit. There's heat, ice, and massage. There's jacuzzis. There's so many things to choose from. There's copper cream. There's DMSO. There's glucosamine.
Magnets, yeah, there's all kinds
MSM,
of stuff.
Yeah, the photon stimulator.
Well, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank you for joining us here on Prescriptions for Health as part of the Progressive Radio Network, and invite you to listen to the program again next Monday and every Monday.
And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week.